Der nächste Talk hat den Titel Digitale Mündigkeit und ist von Lena, die sich mit digitaler Mündigkeit beschäftigt und Technikpaternalismus. Und was das ist, wird sie selber erzählen. Hallo.
Ja, danke. Hi. So viel erzählen wollte ich gar nicht, weil bei der letzten Lesung, die ich gemacht habe, habe ich dann ganz viel geredet und dann hinterher dasselbe nochmal vorgelesen. Und deswegen dachte ich, ich fange einfach erstmal an mit Lesen. Ich habe im Mai mein erstes Buch allgemein rausgebracht, denn diese Kurz- und Mündig-Büchlein da hinten sind ja auch Bücher und davon habe ich schon ein paar geschrieben, aber das erste so richtige, große. Und das ist ganz schön aufregend, so ein Buch geschrieben zu haben und vor allen Dingen ist es schön, wenn man später nochmal drin liest und weiterhin zufrieden mit dem ist, was da drin steht. Und es macht mir tatsächlich auch Spaß, da drin zu lesen und deswegen dachte ich, ich lese euch mal ein bisschen was daraus vor und freue mich natürlich, wenn es euch neugierig macht, mehr zu hören. Ja, und ich fange einfach mal an, oder? Aber erst trinke ich einen Schluck. Trinken, nicht vergessen. Digital hat Charme. Der Traum vom perfekten DJ. In jungen Jahren wünschte ich mir einen persönlichen DJ. Eine Person, die mich unaufdringlich begleitet und mir in jedem Moment die Musik auflegt, die ich gerade hören möchte. Die zu meinem Gemütszustand passt oder einen angestrebten Gemütszustand hervorruft. Diese Person müsste sich so gut mit meinem Musikgeschmack und mit meinen Stimmungen auskennen, dass sie sogar besser wüsste als ich, was ich gerade hören möchte. Dafür würde ich mich diese Person eine Zeit beobachten und mein Verhalten zu studieren. Es ließe sich nicht vermeiden, dass sie sich nicht nur über meinen Musikgeschmack, sondern über mein gesamtes Leben einen guten Überblick bekäme und mich vielleicht sogar besser kennenlernte als ich mich selbst. Diese Informationen sollte sie dann nutzen, um mir die passende Musik aufzulegen, noch ehe ich darüber nachdenken konnte, welche Musik eigentlich passen würde. Mein Beitrag würde sich darauf beschränken, festzustellen, dass es tatsächlich gerade die bestmögliche Musikauswahl wäre und meinem DJ anerkennend zuzunicken. Selbstverständlich wollte ich dazu keinen Menschen versklaven. Bezahlen kann man so einen Vollzeitbegleitservice auch nicht. Und abgesehen davon, dass ich es damals schon ablehnte, mich überwachen zu lassen und mir das Gefühl nicht gefallen hätte, ständig überall hin begleitet zu werden. Es blieb bei einer wilden Fantasie. Auch deshalb, weil es recht unrealistisch ist, dass der eigene Musikgeschmack derart präzise erfasst werden könnte. Oder nicht? Als ich Mitte der Nullerjahre auf die Musikempfehlungsseite Last.fm stieß, legte ich mir sofort einen Account an. Last.fm zeichnete von da an die Musik auf, die ich am Rechner hörte und empfahl mir ähnliche InterpretInnen. Ich konnte mir ansehen, was meine Freunde gerade hörten, Musik kommentieren und sogar meinen Ogg-Player. Damals war MP3 noch nicht frei und deswegen musste man natürlich für freie Formate das Ogg-Format verwenden, an das System anschließen. Es erstellte mir eine Statistik meiner Lieblingslieder und Bands, verglich meinen Musikgeschmack mit dem meiner Freunde und stellte mir Menschen vor, die einen sehr ähnlichen Musikgeschmack hatten wie ich. Dies entsprach in weiten Teilen meinen Vorstellungen. Eine Software hat den Vorteil, dass man sie nicht versklaven muss, damit sie für einen rund um die Uhr arbeitet. Man muss allerdings andere Dinge in Kauf nehmen. Zum Beispiel gibt es keine Funktion, um mein Profil vor der Öffentlichkeit zu schützen. Die Geheimhaltung meines Nicknamens war eigentlich die einzige Möglichkeit, meine Privatsphäre zu schützen. Doch den musste ich ja bekannt geben, wenn ich mit Freunden Musikempfehlungen tauschen wollte. Wer meinen Benutzernamen kannte, konnte sehr viel über mich herausfinden. Außerdem band es mich an den Computer. Einer meiner Lieblingsinterpreten rutschte auf der Skala weit nach unten, weil ich seine Musik noch häufig über die Schallplatte oder CD hörte, die eben nicht an das System angeschlossen sind. Andere InterpretInnen, die ich gar nicht besonders mochte, die sich aber als Hintergrundmusik gut eigneten, und die ich gerne zum Arbeiten oder Aufräumen hörte, schnellten im Ranking nach oben. Das System konnte nicht wahrnehmen, mit welcher Intensität ich ein Stück hörte. Ob ich nebenbei telefonierte oder mit geschlossenen Augen jede einzelne Note verfolgte, wurde nicht erfasst. Das führte dazu, dass ich begann mein Musik...
To change my listening behavior so that the displayed ranking corresponded more to how I myself assessed my taste in music. In this way, the software influenced me even in what I listened to and caused a kind of feedback loop. What the program still lacked compared to the fantasized DJ was the assessment of my state of mind. It could not tell me which music suits me at the moment, but only which music I might like in general. But today, we are not far from the calculation of the emotional state by software. It's only a matter of time before this personal DJ, which can recognize my moods and determine what I want to listen to based on them, is available as an app. Maybe even with all the features I wished to back then. Not just as a luxury item, but affordable for everyone. Unfortunately, we have to fear that affordable will happen in a currency that we all have and that doesn't cost us money, but our privacy. There's, however, one important difference to the personal DJ. They would only be one person who observes me and is constantly in my environment. I would get to know this person as well, and there would be no time left for them to do anything with their knowledge about me, since they would always be busy shadowing me. A company that offers me software that does the same work will expect the same amount of payment as a personal DJ, just in a different currency. But these are several people I do not know and cannot assess. Would I still use the service? When does it ever happen that one gets such an unrealistic use dream which utopia fulfilled so easily? My computer knows me better than I know myself because it watches me permanently and records everything unaltered. Or maybe not. Apparently, errors could occur here too. I already noticed during my experiment with Last.fm that I consciously adjusted my behavior to the program in order to compensate for errors. How often did this happen unconsciously? And how much would I surrender to a company that is so well informed about my emotional state? Wouldn't I also be giving it the power to manipulate my moods? What if the DJ suddenly starts to spoil my hard-earned melancholy mood by replacing whiter shade of pale with if you want to sing out, a song that none of my bad moods can withstand? In the best case, the software could decide whether I conserve my mood or change it. In the worst case, the software would not determine this on the basis of my wishes, but on the wishes of the person who operates my DJ service. I find both of these cases disconcerting. I find it disconcerting when a piece of technology knows more about me than myself or my closest friends. I find it even more disconcerting when I become too comfortable to perceive for myself what my feelings are. But what I find most disconcerting is when I potentially relinquish the power to control my moods to a third party of whom I don't even know who they are, let alone what their agenda is. However, I find most disconcerting of all how few people ask themselves such questions before using such a service. What impact would it have on society if we all used such a DJ service? Unfortunately, it does not end with the services to which one voluntarily submits unthinkingly because they fulfill a silly pipe dream. More and more applications are no longer avoidable for us, or rather, doing without them has serious consequences for us. If I don't want to entrust my fingerprints to the state, because contrary to all original assurances, it didn't protect my biometric image well and pass it on to law enforcement agencies, I will no longer be able to leave the Schengen area. If I want to travel anonymously by train, I now have to go through a lot of inconvenience and pay more money. If I want to communicate with friends, I'm forced to use WhatsApp. And if I want to find a warm office in the morning, I have to install a smart home app on my cell phone that conveniently allows me to control the heating. I cannot order a pair of shoes from Globetrotter without a user account being created with my name at their online store, for which I have to enter my postal address and other information. Many banks now require you to install their app for credit card payments, which of course is only available in the Google Play Store, for which you have to accept Google's completely unacceptable terms and conditions. Particularly inevitable is the forced digitization in the medical sector. Without an electronic health card, I cannot get any medical care, and when I send an analog letter to my health insurer, I address it to the scanning center, where it is, you guessed it, digitized before it is forwarded to my caseworker. I love technology, my smartphone and my computer. I love the many possibilities it offers for democracy and human communication. I think it is wonderful that you can find an instruction manual for an old used vacuum cleaner online and that lonely people can find like-minded people. And I'm extremely happy that sick people can use digital technology to cope better with their illness and even improve their chances of recovery, precisely because I see the great potential that digitization holds. I think it is necessary to take a critical look at where technical development is leading us. To date, there is no universally valid ethical framework that we can use to guide the direction of technological development. Internet companies, for example, are pursuing completely different goals than the people who used to operate mailboxes and are now calling for free networks. I think there's some here in the tent. Oh, no, I lost my point. Where are those free networks? There. Sometimes it's really governments and powerful political forces use the net to manipulate elections and political decisions. See, for example, the Brexit. For others, the internet enables them to participate in life, people with disabilities, for example, or to find friends around the world. This offers the opportunity, in the sense of Bertolt Brecht and Andy Warhol, for everyone to have their own personal space to realize his or her potential. At the same time, however, corporations provide the space and exploit it for their own business interests by dictating rules and centralizing. In doing so, they threaten to displace other plants in our community life. Precisely because I welcome technological development, expect a lot of good from it, I'm particularly critical of it, especially because I feel it as a privilege to live in precisely this time of upheaval. I see it as my responsibility to do my part to ensure that it develops in a desirable direction. The question is how we actually want to deal with the many opportunities that digitally networked communication offers us. If this is to become something that is good for people, which helps them to achieve democracy and a peaceful world, then we should have certain demands on how we use it. Mature approach to digital technology that neither demonizes it nor blindly claims it would correspond to this cause. Maturity, not just in the sense of being mature because someone has told us that we are now allowed to do so, because legal things, but also in the sense of responsible because we are prepared to take responsibility for what we are doing. Digital literacy is the awareness that there might be a problem with the technology one uses. It is the willingness to take responsibility for one's own actions in relation to one's own interests, but also in relation to the interests of other individual people, and also in relation of the interest of humans as a whole group.
Skipping some pages because we want to listen to something else, not only the beginning part. There's a big chapter on artificial intelligence, like complex imitations, advanced imitations, artificial, in German, KI. We talk a lot about complex intelligence. I jumped forward. I'm so glad I'm not a false positive. Often AI is about assignment or predictions. Is somebody creditworthy? Will someone commit a crime? Is a person receptive to advertisement of my product? Should I hire a person? Is there a car on the photo? Could the person be about to commit a terrorist attack? The obvious reference value one first considers is how often the algorithm is right. How many terrorists has it actually detected? 100%? Well, fantastic. Then we can go home. Unfortunately not, because in addition to the value of the correct assignment, the true positive, there's another very relevant value, the false positive. For example, the amount of people who are falsely marked as terrorists, but who are not terrorists at all. If an AI classifies half of all people as terrorists, it is not surprising that among them are also 100% of all terrorists. The value of false positive is aggravated by the fact that it can have very far-reaching consequences for affected people, and that even a very small percentage represents a very large problem. In the facial recognition pilot project that took place in Berlin Südkreuz train station, excellent results were boasted. 70 to 80% true positives were measured and proudly announced. The value of false positives initially remained vague at less than 1%, which somehow feels like really a little. The whole thing was celebrated as a success. But if you do math and know that there are about 100,000 people on the road at Southkreuz every day, you notice at this small rate, up to 1,000 people per day would be rated, would be wrongly assigned. Even at the later announced value of 0.1%, that would still be 100 false criminals a day, 36,500 a year. Measured against the goal of the exercise, which is to identify criminals, this is far too high a figure. And the problem is real. More and more examples are accumulated of such mistakes. In Georgia, in December 2022, a man had to spend nearly a week in jail before it turned out that the facial recognition software mistook him for a wanted thief. The example is particularly delicate because the man is a person of color, and facial recognition software here is racist and particularly prone to error because it's trained primarily on white people. But even when facial recognition works correctly, it is used in increasingly problematic situations. Imagine you want to accompany your child on a school trip to a musical, and you're the only mother who's not allowed in. Why? Because you work for a law firm that is involved in a lawsuit against the operation of the musical. This also happened in late 2022 in the United States, this time in New York. While facial recognition is increasingly used in a very haphazard and flawed manner, its utility is extremely limited. Assuming 10 criminals per month walk through the train station Südkreuz, this is supposedly so successful software would detect 8 of them, which 80% true positives, and at the same time it would accuse 3,000 innocent people as criminals, 0.1% false positives, and set the police on their heels accordingly. Unwantedly questioning and being late to work, including while the police tries to find out the 8 criminals among the 3,000 or so people. You may see it differently, but I don't consider this as a successful test, especially since even these conceivable bad results are still suspected of being embellished. Imagine this rate of false positives for a fire alarm in your office. If the fire alarm goes off 10 times a day, you won't get up and rush out when it rings again after 3 days at the latest. It's just unfortunate when there's an actual fire and no one expects a true positive anymore. By the way, there's also true negatives and false negatives. Here, you two, you would rather not belong to the false ones because he is about to have been wrongly sorted out. For example, in case of positions of which one would actually be eligible, but was inadvertently wrongly evaluated, or when it comes to the question of a loan from the bank. A false negative is just as mean as a false positive in a terrorist detector. All right.
Yeah, I try. I looked through all of it with my 80-year-old father. I tried to write in a way so it doesn't need a lot of prior knowledge and still is fun to read. So it's parents compatible. So when I started training for it, I had to find out that I will skip the paternalistic traffic light because I wanted to introduce such abstruse examples, but I leave it up to you to read those to yourself because I wanted to show you the area about how they bring light to the black box. The good thing is you can free yourself from the immaturity. You need some practice and time, invest time. But if you are prepared for that and have the time, you can integrate into your daily life. The beginning, there is a change of habit. You have to decide to be responsible for your actions. And that's the most important step. All the other questions will come by themselves. Here we'll talk about how this will be concrete. 30 mature minutes. Take care as often as possible the 30-minute maturity rule, which is try to solve any computer problem for 30 minutes by yourself without using any search engines. With search engines which are allowed, but after that only ask for other help. That's part of the XKCD technical support sheet. So if you know XKCD, it's a 627 comic where you can read those rules. This has two benefits. You practice to deal with your problems yourselves. And secondly, you practice to save the easy problems prior. You will find out how often you can find a solution within 5 and 10 minutes. So you need morally help.
The people who will support you with this problem will be thankful to you because they can realize very quickly whether this is a real problem or whether you're just too lazy to just Google yourself or to take action, to meet again. I'm talking about experience here from both sides. When you then decide to get help, don't let the other person take the device out of your hands, even if you don't have any clue what you're doing. Please keep the control. Please ask for help controlling the devices, but don't give away the control. Passwords are only known by you, and when they are needed, you enter them. Let them explain you what they're doing with your device, and make yourself clear that it's your responsibility, even if you don't understand what's going on at the moment. Vomiting to overcome the reflex of vomiting. Okay, well, it's nice what you say, but I'm not a computer science diploma person, and I don't know much about computer. With this feeling, you're not alone, but for mature handling of these kind of devices, it's not necessary to have a computer science study. The media competence is something we talked about, but you have to work with your capabilities, and piece by piece you will learn more about it. We also talked about it that without learning how to do food technology, you would still take your responsibility. You would, for example, not eat a bad orange in the, you wouldn't put it in the shopping bag even if you didn't study it. So you take the responsibility. Kant said that you have a lack of determination.
I want to tell you something about rats. Two animated rats, specifically from the Disney film Ratatouille. Remy and Emi are brothers. One loves is a foodie, the other one eats everything. When Emi is eating something undefinable, gross thing, Remy asks, "How can you eat that?" Emi's answer is, "When you have conquered the reflex to vomit, then it works." We know such a reflex when talking about computers. To understand this, I would have to read this and understand it and think about it. I am just not up to this right now. So we vomit out many computer questions before we actually thought through them. This is not for all the people, only for people who know about computers. This is for applies to everyone who has to deal with computers. Just some have learned how to deal with that. And here applies, when you have conquered the reflex to vomit, it's not that bad anymore. And it's not a wonder that we don't want to deal with stuff where we only understand 5%. But this doesn't change. Whoever works with computers will not come around that to accept that a lot of stuff will never be clear to you. This is not just for computer muggles, but also computer wizards. Some will be intimidated by things they don't know, and some try to find within all the things what they need.
So just fight against the reflex to vomit. You can get it talking to you after 30 minutes if it's still necessary, but maybe it's not necessary anymore by then. I'm asking for the time. 15 more minutes. Oh, there's a nice chapter in the back that is really important to me. Let's see, it needs some time. Let's check where we'll end up. I discarded many already. Okay, it's fitting perfectly. We are reaching there. And I'm going to the chapter Freedom, Manipulation, and there's also a chapter I would have loved to read. It's about the manipulated sovereign. What happens when in a democracy of the sovereign, the sovereign is not deciding on its own, but it's manipulated so that he doesn't know if it's like still free or no longer free or what's that. But there's a different chapter which is close to my heart, and I would like to take some time for that one. And it is attached to a talk that we've had here at the beginning of the camp from Anja-Lisa Gonsorb. Thank you very much for your inspirations for this chapter. It's about cyber and information war. Why are democratic societies shaken to the core when there's no trust on and no common knowledge base? We already talked about it. If it comes to cyber war, this problem is like super obvious. But before we start with this topic, I'd like to introduce some wordings. War rhetoric is nothing unproblematic. There's reason to debate whether the language usages
On one hand, I find it very sensible that he talks exactly what he what's happening, but on the other hand, psychic violence is rarely seen in the same light as physical violence, and it's very important to think about the importance and that it could actually be seen as an act of war. Digital technology can be used as a weapon, and we have to talk about this. Whoever wants to attack our state or want to weaken them can do this by manipulating the masses. For example, by undermining the trust into the political living together. So, for example, in the info war, one can spread fake news, and bring whole systems into weaken whole systems. For example, by giving people catalyzing anger, and this can happen in several ways. So this will kind of give an external actor, and so people won't see those. And humans with something to say are instrumentalized by people in other states who don't really care for this special want. And it carries uncertainty, because it's not clear whether protests are actually done by the people involved or just by other interests or powers. Cyberkrieg can look very differently. It can go against civilians or infrastructure, critical infrastructure, or military infrastructure. But how can we know that for certainty if attacks are not identifiable and can be fingated? Then there is a lot of uncertainty about useful actions or reactions, and it's impossible to get those. So one doesn't know, was it an attack, or from where did it came from? Are there fake traces which want to gain me a... How do we know that gas pipelines or firefighter IT is not part of the goals of the attacks? Not any manipulation comes from bots or some algorithms. Besides the goal for money or misinformation, destabilization, and, well, power. The politic uses destructive mechanisms of connection or networks to manipulate their own population, but also the politic of other countries. And that works in a way one thinks about who's the villain. And then we look at their surroundings, so the more the better. And we need a true center, and it's especially nice if there's discrimination or anti-Semitism involved. And then there's a lot of identities one gives oneself, which all fake to be true humans and escalate the dispute around. And there are several tactics. One, the most obvious one, is to acknowledge the opinions. And one can also weaken another, the opposing side, by talking for them, but talking nonsense. And then the opponent is in dispute or just has to deal with a lot of other things and cannot be active anymore. And the worst thing is the escalated conflict is normally an important and very serious thing. And if the discriminated group is trying to get something done.
So they are sometimes they're just instrumentalized and they don't recognize us. So the actual topic is not less important, but the dialogue is not targeted to solve that topic, but it's just a tool to have fronts more clear. So once you start to look for these kind of strategies, you have to pay attention before, otherwise you may get paranoid. Okay, I think we need another example. When President Putin on 21st of February last year decided to attack the neighbor country Ukraine, there was solidarity between all men. Refugees, trains were like provided freely, and everybody was getting together. Also, there was the Ukraine, and the president Vladimir Zelensky was very good in talking to the public in a very charismatic way. When in Europe we lost some track of the democracy more and more, the Ukrainians showed to the public world that they are ready to risk everything. But the unity in the EU, of course, had some broken parts, and they were not hard to find. They were like jumping to your eyes. Europe. In Europe, there like people are being drowned in the ocean every day, and they don't the European countries not always participate in rescuing them, and sometimes even like reduce their chance of surviving. So people who are part of this GAO or the largest accident that we can imagine, they of course had a different perspective. So Poland, which was very helpful until now, it was not helpful to help people in need. And of course it wasn't a surprise when there were people not being able to pass the border just because of their skin color. So for our recipe, this is an example then. The perfect conflict with realistic points on both sides with not an easy solution. Of course, the truth is the first victim of the war, and I'm not in the illusion that I have anything big to say here. I don't want you to believe one or the other story. I don't want to put on remarks to like check proof. It's not important who is on the right side. It is about pointing out that in such a situation it's not possible to know the state of the fact. We all know that we have a limit with our horizon and our filter bubble. We know that these methods are like used by all parties. We know that manipulation is on the deepest psychological level. It takes place. The only thing we know for sure is that we don't know anything. And then we should choose who is our like loved one. There's a voice on Twitter that shows that the correctly criticized critic of racism is used by Poland to destroy European unified feeling. Back then you could use Twitter, so there was another voice on Twitter which said maybe this is propaganda and you have no proof of it. Maybe both voices are coming from Russia, maybe one from Russia and one from NATO, or maybe none, maybe one or both voices are just like put onto that idea from somebody else that was on control. And who's independent? Even if both are independent, who's on the right? And does it matter if somebody is applauding you from the opposite side if the topic is important enough? I don't have any answer. I just think that it's important to realize that it's just a vehicle for something else, and looking into the details is not helping to get a picture of the entire setup. And I also know that it's not going to help if we have like two sides digging their protection deeper and deeper. I don't want to be a ball in the game of power, which I'm not controlling. So majority may be off topic. Only if I realize this, I have the opportunity to be a major person in this. The information war, discussion toxicity, is not attacking us on a molecular level. It's targeting our communication, the fundament of our living together, the trust within each other, with in between each other. It's like attacking our social contract. It has destructive potentials, even if the methods stopped being used. When we are all paranoid, our contracts are like not working anymore. The game with the uncertainty is a superpower of those attacks. The Trumps and Putins are not about people convincing them to believe in their point. It believes them. It's about making people to not believe anything anymore. And this targets structures which are like involving, like where people are like part of the decision process. And of course, this helps to people. This helps people where they want to control everything. So democracies can only lose in cyber war. So everybody who's democratic and who wants to be democratic should really, really, really not participate in it, and also work towards all global players to not participate in it either. All the powers should be divided to protect against attacks and digital infrastructure attacks. Okay, I'm running out of time, but yeah. There's also the head of the people that need to realize when they and their interests are instrumentalized. Digital maturity will be a central element of cyber defense. So methods of info war will be need to be internationally judged down. We need clear consequences for people that use them, and we need to pursue the people that are like actually doing this. Of course, this is easier to say than to do, because how can you quantify a computer program? It's not like a grenade. You can use it multiple times. For example, everybody of us just can have one plane carrier are not like compatible with computer programs. And of course, assumptions made on this cannot be that votes are manipulated can not just be left alone. You are not allowed to touch the freedom of expressions. We need mechanisms that protect us from abusing even those mechanisms, and this must be internationally negotiated. It's a very, very large task. But if we don't want to turn towards dystopia, then we need to start thrilling now.